What do we do when we've reached the line with inotropes, vasopressors? Where do we go from there?
I think that the choice is not going to be ours.
These devices won't fix that problem.
Intra-aortic balloon pump has been shown to have no mortality benefit.
We need to get aggressive early.
The hemodynamic benefits, what does this get you?
That's going to bleed like all get out.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. And this month, this podcast, a very exciting podcast talking about a specific aspect of cardiogenic shock. And that's basically, what do we do when we've reached the line with inotropes, vasopressors? Where do we go from there? Do we need or institute and even think about what's called mechanical circulatory support devices? But before jumping into the discussion, let me bring in two of my other outstanding colleagues, Dr. John Greenwood and Dr. Peter W. Gentlemen, how are you this month?
Doing well.
Yeah, doing great, Mike. Just getting ramped up for flu season and keeping busy around our way in Philadelphia. I think the weather's about to turn pretty cold up here. So looking forward to a busy, busy winter.
I would echo that. And we're already starting to see a few flu cases, at least in Baltimore at the medical center here. And that's something we should probably tackle on an upcoming podcast in terms of critical illness secondary to influenza and the respiratory issues and potential mechanical ventilation and maybe even VV ECMO for some of these patients on the sicker end. But I digress. Let's circle back and let's focus on cardiogenic shock. Admittedly, it is not something that we are seeing all the time in the ED, but as famous emergency physicians, such as Stuart Swadron, would say, we need to know what we need to know, and then we need to know one step more. And that's really the focus of this discussion, talking about mechanical circulatory support devices. What do we need to know and think about? What do we need to anticipate in our specialists with respect to these devices, and when do we put them in our sick patients? So Peter, kind of set the stage for us as we head in to talk about the specific devices themselves.
Absolutely. And so the question that we ask ourselves is, how likely is it that I'm going to see this patient or this type of patient on my next shift? And I think that we need to understand that cardiogenic shock really complicates about 8% of all STEMIs. So 8% of all STEMIs. It's going to be higher in those patients who are post-cardiac arrest, but an 8% of STEMIs is a number that you might want to remember. Now, again, if you're in cardiogenic shock, you know, mean arterial blood pressure is less than 65, the mortality attributable to that is pretty high, and it approaches 50% in most studies. Our traditional treatment of cardiogenic shock has been vasoactive agents, both inotropes, dobutamine, as well as vasopressors, and that being predominantly Levofed, understanding that epinephrine as a vasopressor in the setting of cardiogenic shock actually increases mortality, doesn't reduce it. And then the other measure that we use is possibly intra-aortic balloon pumps while attempting to get the patient to definitive care, revascularization with either PCI or CABG. Now, most recently, intra-aortic balloon pump has been shown to have no mortality benefit, and that's based on the SHOCK 2 trial, intra-aortic balloon pump SHOCK 2 trial. So be wary of that, so we shouldn't be pushing towards that end. There's a recommendation for the use of intra-aortic balloon pump has now been downgraded from a class 1 to a 2A in both the U.S. and Europe. So both our American Heart Association and the European Cardiac crowd has both on record as saying that intra-aortic balloon pump isn't what they thought it was. So similarly, percutaneous mechanical circulatory support is also given a class 2B recommendation. So the use of percutaneous ventricular assist devices has increased more than 30-fold over the past few years. And so I think that that's pretty important for us to understand.
Outstanding, Peter. And it's surprising to see, and as we'll talk about, there's very little literature, randomized control trials on these devices, but I'm going to bet that almost all of our listeners are familiar with these names, not only ECMO, but Impella devices, tandem heart, and these tend to be the most common percutaneous support devices. And I think overall, the goal of these devices, as we would expect, is simply to improve a patient's cardiac function while we're treating the cause of their cardiogenic shock, while we're awaiting the return of their native cardiac function. So, John, let me turn to you as someone truly an expert in managing these devices with respect to your time in the CSICU. Let's start off first with the Impella. It's something that's been around a little while, but more and more and more I'm hearing this name in terms of a circulatory support device. We have it at our medical center. A number of patients are getting it in terms of therapy and treatment for their cardiogenic shock. But take us through, you know, what it is and really, what's the benefit of using this particular device?
Absolutely, Mike. And I think a lot of the focus over the past 5-10 years has really been tackling the problem, which is reduce antegrade cardiac blood flow. The way the balloon pump truly was designed to work was basically to reduce your diastolic blood pressure. So every time your heart took a beat, it would be able to pump more blood out because it was up against less resistance. And so that was kind of a backwards approach to improving cardiac output. And it really only increases your output in general by about a half to a full liter of flow. And so it doesn't give you all that much bang for your buck. The one thing I will say about balloon pumps where there may be some benefit, and this is going to be nearly impossible to study, would be an acute mitral regurgitation. So you have that patient who comes in with an MI and a papillary muscle rupture, pulmonary edema, and identified as acute mitral regurg. That may provide some additional benefit by the reduced diastolic function to help your native heart kind of move blood forward instead of backwards. But getting back to the question about the Impella itself, the whole concept is that this is an intracardiac pump. So it literally is placed and rests within the left ventricle itself across the left ventricular outflow tract. So it actually does what the left ventricle is trying to do, or at least assists it in terms of moving blood in an antegrade fashion forward. So it produces a non-pulsatile flow that goes directly out to the brain and all the other vital organs. Now, this Impella pump, it almost looks like a pencil. So it's very thin and long, and you have to be careful inserting it. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes, but just to get a sense of the function of the Impella itself. So there's a few different models, if you will, of the device itself. So there's a support model that can provide probably about 2.5 liters per minute of flow. And that's not designed to really give you a full replacement or full support. It's just kind of supportive. But the nice thing about it is that you don't need to insert a very large cannula to place it. It can be done percutaneously without any cut down. So it's a little bit smaller, and that's because the motor's a little bit smaller. Now, there's a in-between or middle grade device that the Impella Cardiac Power that provides about 4 liters per minute of flow. And again, this still can be introduced percutaneously, doesn't require a cut down. And then the last model, if you will, is the 5 liter per minute device that can almost provide full cardiac support. Now, there are some complications and some things that we're always worried about in cardiac surgery with these devices. One of them is migration. So the way these work is they spin at relatively high RPMs to produce the amount of flow that they need to achieve. And as a result of that, they can move. And so we have to be very cognizant about keeping track of the device and make sure it's located in the right place. And on top of that, you can generate a lot of hemolysis. So if you think about kind of the motor, the way it spins, it's almost like a propeller on the back of a submarine or a biplane. So the motor spins around really, really fast and can produce a lot of blood damage. So you can get a lot of hemolysis with it too. Now, just recently, within the past year, Impella was approved to distribute an RVAD version of this, so it can actually support right ventricular function as well, which is a pretty big breakthrough for them and something I think we'll be seeing a lot of more in the next few years. Now, let's talk a little bit more about how these are inserted, because I think it's worth knowing as a emergency provider, just to get a sense of where your interventionalist. And in general, these are inserted by interventional cardiologists. There are some cardiologists and cardiac surgeons that will place them as well, but these have really been taken hold of by the interventional cardiology group. So they're inserted percutaneously through usually the femoral artery, usually on the left-hand side, but depending on the patient, they can be required to put in elsewhere. And in some places, they may put them in the axillary artery, but then the motor itself is advanced across the aortic valve in a retrograde fashion. Now, as I mentioned, the full support device, the Impella 5, has to actually be done by cut down. So you actually have to do a femoral cut down for this, and that's because the sheath is pretty large. So the function of this is fairly simple. So it rests within the left ventricular cavity itself, and it sucks up blood through the distal portion, and then spins it around and ejects it out the proximal portion right at the aortic root. Now, ultimately, this will reduce the amount of cardiac work because there's going to be less blood left in the ventricle for it to squeeze out. And so the theory is that this provides not only increased flow, but also decreased myocardial work. So one of the things that the balloon pump was actually designed to do, it just does it a lot better. So there are a few contraindications just to be aware about, and that includes severe aortic valve disease or mechanical aortic valve, obviously. And then any sort of thrombus due to poor forward flow can be a contraindication because clearly it'd probably be bad if that sucked it in and then occluded the pump itself. So there is a little bit of literature about this, particularly the Impellas. And there are two small randomized control trials in particular comparing Impella to standard therapy, Equipoise being the IABP. And then what they did show was that the Impella worked better. So it provided more flow, so increased cardiac index at 30 minutes, so it works a lot better. But unfortunately, the mortality was about the same at 30 days, so not that much of a difference in patient-centered outcome. Now, a more recent study from the Impella registry, now given this is from the company itself, looked at their patients in cardiogenic shock. The Impella 2.5 liter flow pre-PCI, so in patients who were high-risk PCI, did have a reduced mortality. And I can tell you from my perspective, I'm seeing a lot of patients being referred to us who end up getting a supportive Impella put in people with high-grade left main lesions in exchange for what used to be probably a balloon pump. In the anticipation, should something go wrong, they do have some support. There are some other single center non-randomized studies that have shown some favorable outcomes with Impella, but to be honest, overall, we still don't know. And I think getting back to your original opening about cardiogenic shock, what Peter did a great job kind of overviewing is that when we have a patient in cardiogenic shock, I think our biggest issue is that we tend to go down this path of medical management. But the more we dig into these patients, what we're realizing is that we need to get aggressive early. And so if we're starting to have escalating vasopressors or inotropic support needed, it's possible that moving to mechanical support to really fix or temporize the problem early may actually give us a best shot at salvaging that patient. These patients are really sick. And there are some other options, though, in terms of percutaneous support. Mike, you mentioned the tandem heart. Maybe we should go through that a little bit more.
I think that's great. And something I probably should have said at the beginning of our podcast here is there's a great new review article, a concise definitive review on this topic that was just published in Critical Care Medicine by Dr. Miller, entitled exactly what we're talking about, Advanced Percutaneous Mechanical Circulatory Support Devices for Cardiogenic Shock. We certainly will have that citation in the handout for this podcast. The other thing is there's three pictures that really, when you take a look at a picture of the Impella or a schematic, along with the next two things that we'll talk about, a lot of this makes sense if you just haven't seen the device and can't visualize it in your head at the moment. So with that, Peter, let's talk about the other most common percutaneous circulatory support device, and that is the tandem heart. So kind of take us through that as opposed to what John did with the Impella.
Absolutely. It's really continuous flow. It uses a centrifugal extracorporeal assist device. It takes oxygenated blood from the left atrium and returns it to the femoral artery. There's actually an inflow cannula that's inserted percutaneously, and that goes through the route of the femoral vein, and it's advanced into the left atrium. This procedure requires cath lab capabilities and a cardiologist who's experienced in transseptal puncture. Before, we mentioned that this requires either interventional cardiologist or a cardiothoracic surgeon. So you're going to need that on your team, those people experienced with tandem heart. And what it does is it takes oxygenated blood that's pumped through the femoral artery, through that cannula at a rate of 3.5 to 5 liters per minute. So, you know, again, what we're talking about, cardiac output sustaining levels. The hemodynamic benefits, what does this get you? So it's near systemic blood flow rates, as I said before, 3.5 to 5 liters per minute. It improves mean arterial pressures. It also improves pulmonary artery occlusive pressures as well. Overall, it'll reduce cardiac workload. And how does it do this? It does it by decreasing left ventricular pressures that are needed to generate, as well as volume of flow through the left ventricular outflow tract. What are the contraindications of the tandem heart? Well, intracardiac thrombus and ventricular septal defects. So if we look at what the data for support of this, it's based on a review of 117 patients with refractory cardiogenic shock. And this is refractory despite intra-aortic balloon pump or high-dose vasopressor use. They used the tandem heart, which therefore improved hemodynamics significantly and was associated with a lower than expected 30-day mortality. They also had two randomized studies that compared tandem heart with intra-aortic balloon pump in patients with acute MI. This was acute MI complicated by cardiogenic shock. Each reported an improved hemodynamic parameter, but had more complications in the tandem heart than in the intra-aortic balloon pump. Neither study really demonstrated a significant change in mortality.
Outstanding. Well, I think, Peter, you mentioned this just now, and then John also alluded to this in the literature that's on these circulatory support devices, and it seems pretty scant at this point, and that overall we're looking at better hemodynamics, but it doesn't seem to perhaps portray out some mortality benefit yet.
I think that's fair, Mike. And as we get into probably one of the more popular modes of mechanical support, that's important to note. So with the Impella and the tandem heart itself, if we're considering this patient who may even be down in the emergency department when your interventionalist comes downstairs to place one of these devices, both of these actually require your lungs to actually be working quite well. And intuitively, that makes sense. So if the blood is moving from the right ventricle to the left ventricle, so your right ventricle has to be working well in order to move blood from right to left, and it needs to be oxygenated adequately to then provide oxygenated blood to the rest of the body, which the pump is designed to do. If you have someone who's in cardiogenic shock, massive pulmonary edema, hypoxic on top of this, these devices won't fix that problem. They'll provide adequate flow, but the blood that they're flowing will just be completely blue and deoxygenated. So it's not going to really help all that much, especially with the Impella. Now, the nice thing about the tandem heart is you can actually splice in an oxygenator to it. So it's basically a small little box that infuses the blood with oxygen, and it almost acts like a modified peripheral ECMO. So you can oxygenate the blood in addition to provide flow support. The one caveat to that is with these tandem hearts, especially as they return blood to the femoral artery, if the blood isn't pumped enough or isn't strong enough to reach all the way up to the head vessels from the femoral artery, you can get some pretty significant upper body hypoxemia. So the normoxic blood goes to the bottom half of the body, and then at some point, the blood stops flowing retrograde, and then all the blue blood that comes out of the hypoxic lungs goes to the head and the rest of the body. So if you're responsible for at least a part of the team who's managing these patients early on, one thing you definitely want to look out for in these tandem heart patients, or at least the Impella patients, is hypoxemia, because that can be a major problem with some of these percutaneous devices.
Outstanding. I love those points, John. And as you mentioned ECMO, let's just touch on this one last mechanical circulatory support, and that is ECMO. And we won't do a deep dive, but just to be complete in our discussion, as many of our listeners know, we would be talking about VA ECMO in this case. So cardiopulmonary support. In essence, the device itself, many of our listeners have seen it, maybe have even inserted and placed somebody on ECMO. But in essence, it simply includes a non-pulsatile pump, a heat exchanger, and a membrane oxygenator that allows for us to provide the patient with a full biventricular support along with a gas exchange. The cannulas are placed peripherally, so most often via the femoral vein and artery, or there can be central placement of the cannulas through the right atrium and ascending aorta. Now, in essence, these reperfusion cannulas, these catheters, are placed to allow blood flow distal to the insertion site. So we routinely insert a catheter to direct blood flow, usually to the extremity where the catheters are, because one of the complications, as we'll mention briefly, is limb ischemia. But in essence, what does ECMO do? Well, removes venous blood, reduces cardiac preload, and then reinfuses that blood through the arterial cannula, thereby increasing the patient's mean arterial pressure by increasing both systolic along with diastolic pressures. Now, much like what we've just talked about, really the evidence for ECMO and cardiogenic shock is still mounting. It's emerging. We really don't have any RCTs just yet comparing ECMO with the other peripheral ventricular assist devices. Notwithstanding, in terms of meta-analysis what is out there. There's a recent meta-analysis of cohort studies that in essence stated that ECMO had a higher 30-day survival when compared to the more traditional intra-aortic balloon pump that Peter mentioned a little while ago, and along with the other peripherally inserted ventricular assist devices. So let's kind of come down the home stretch here on our discussion. We've talked about a few contraindications, and that would be certainly significant aortic valve disease, especially in the case of the Impella. Also, in terms of these patients, when these devices are placed, we're doing systemic anticoagulation. So patients who can't tolerate being anticoagulated, and then potentially someone with severe or significant peripheral vascular disease. John, let me turn back to you, since you quite often deal with these devices, the complications that arise from them. You mentioned a few in terms of the deoxygenated blood. What are a few other complications of these devices that our listeners should be on the lookout for?
No, absolutely. So any device that's inserted through a large peripheral artery, particularly either the axillary or the femoral artery, really need to pay attention to that distal limb perfusion. You can get away with this after initial insertion for 30 minutes or so, but if there's any sign of decreased flow, change in color of the limb itself, mottling color, need to be doing at least vascular checks fairly frequently immediately after insertion. Now, we can also get bleeding. So oftentimes, at least with our VA ECMO patients, we'll give them a 10,000 unit bolus of heparin. And the arterial system is a high pressure system. So if you have any injury to the arterial side whatsoever, that's going to bleed like all get out. So need to stay on top, look for hematomas around the insertion site, particularly in the larger vessels, and it's femoral artery in particular. Infections, we don't usually see these right away. Usually that comes a week or two down the road. It's more common potentially with the VA ECMO patients, where it's a little bit more of a stable platform in terms of duration of therapy. You can go a little bit longer, but good site checks on a daily basis, make sure the dressings are good up in the ICU, that there's no signs of redness or anything, is really, really important. And oftentimes these patients will get empiric antibiotics right up front as if they were getting a surgery. So a single dose of Vanc or Keflex, you know, or depending whatever your institution uses for surgical prophylaxis. Thromboembolic events are an important complication to know about. So you might start getting decreased flows, a little bit of chatter from the device itself. And if you're ever having mechanical flow issues, you have to think about subtherapeutic anticoagulation or a clot that you might not have known about. And then we talked a little bit about hemolysis as well. So in addition to blood breakdown, like we talked about the hemorrhage that you can get around the site itself. Now, this is not just limited to local bleeding, but certainly bleeding elsewhere. So if the patient had low cardiac output for a period of time and suffered a subsequent stroke, it's not uncommon that we get patients who develop hemorrhagic conversion of those ischemic areas and can bleed. And I think from our perspective, we can do a lot of things in the hospital. We can fix a lot of problems. One thing we can't fix is brain injury. And so that's something we're always on the lookout for. And if a patient does develop acute intracranial hemorrhage, we need to act on that fast if we're going to salvage that patient. So CNS bleeds are common in addition to some acute kidney injury, depending on the flow rates of the device itself, how bad the cardiogenic shock was preceding the device implantation. The incidence of AKI is as high as 80%. So up to 80% of patients who present in cardiogenic shock who go on to mechanical support may need to require renal replacement therapy. So renal perfusion is important. And again, highlighting the importance of reestablishing adequate blood flow early. So Mike, kick it back to you a little bit. So there are some device-specific complications, in addition to just like kind of general critical care organ dysfunctions. Would you want to run through those a little bit?
Absolutely. So with our first device, the Impella, you had mentioned this already, but with that spinning motor, the Impella is most commonly associated with hemolysis. And if you start to see signs of hemolysis, one of the ways to treat that is simply reducing the speed of the device. That will reduce the degree of hemolysis that occurs. You also mentioned migration, John. The Impella has been associated with left ventricular perforation, pretty bad complication. So certainly we're going to be monitoring these patients, and all of them are going to be in the ICU. With respect to the tandem heart and ECMO, that's most often associated, as you mentioned, with limb ischemia, hemorrhage, and vascular injury. And then with the tandem heart, as Peter described, as it's going across the septum from the right to left atrium, patients can have a residual atrial septal defect due to the transseptal approach. And then you've already mentioned the stuff with ECMO in terms of Harlequin syndrome, and then in terms of just overall hemorrhage with those catheters and downstream limb ischemia, something that we're going to be monitoring the patient for. So some things to look for in terms of complications as you manage patients on this device. Peter, I'm looking to you to close us out here. We've talked about a few important things, some really nice pearls and pitfalls and things to look for as we implement the use of these mechanical circulatory devices. Bring us home. Is there any way that we can say which one we should choose based upon which patient?
Well, again, I think that the choice is not going to be ours. And I think that this begs for our listeners to really be tuned in to our cardiothoracic surgeons and our interventional cardiologists to figure out which device, which mechanical device is going to be their go-to device, and then familiarize themselves with whether that be Impella, whether it be ECMO, or whether it be Tandem Heart. And so they understand what the indications are, the contraindications, and again, work in tandem or work in league with those interventional cardiologists to offer the best care for the patients who are in cardiogenic shock.
Very, very nice way to wrap things up in terms of this podcast, Peter. My thanks to the both of you. Gentlemen, this has been a hugely important and very, very helpful podcast. These are things that we are certainly seeing more and more. We are starting to use more and more, and we're looking for the complications, monitoring them, and learning much more about these devices to get patients through their cardiogenic shock, ultimately, till we can treat the cause of their shock and their native function returns. If any of you have any questions for us from this podcast, please shoot us an email through the website. We do want to announce that there'll be some nice, exciting changes to the website itself. We're going to be upgrading, refreshing the website over the next 2 to 3 months, so look for that on our homepage. Also, it's not too late. Peter, is it? Do we still have room at Critical Points?
We still have room. There's a few spots left for Critical Points in San Diego for the first weekend in December. So it's going to start November 30th and run through the 3rd of December.
Outstanding. As we've said many times before, one of our most favorite conferences of the year that routinely gets accolades in terms of just how the conference is run, much more personal, interactive with the instructors, hands-on simulation, just a really fabulous course. And if for some reason you just can't make it this year, look for Critical Points again and plan on it next December. And with that, we'll bring this podcast to a close and then talk to you after Thanksgiving. So for all of you in the U.S., we want to wish you a very happy, healthy, and safe holiday season. Bye for now.